talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. Well, it's our final show of the year and we've got a special one for you. Tonight we're looking at the life and legacy of the composer Gustav Mahler and we'll explore how he battled anti-Semitism to be recognised as one of the world's greatest composers and also how he tried to capture the breadth of human experience in his symphonies. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life, music and legacy of Gustav Mahler. Born in 1860 in Bohemia, Mahler was a pioneering composer and conductor whose symphonies and songs bridged Romanticism and Modernism. He died in 1911 and his works were later banned by the Nazis because of his Jewish heritage. Today, Mahler's music is acclaimed for its emotional depth and complexity, but his work is not easily categorised. As Peter Franklin shows in his groundbreaking study, Mahler was a sensitive thinker, a dictatorial conductor, an iconoclast, as well as a traditionalist. And so in tonight's show, we want to assess his remarkable legacy. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Laura Tunbridge is Professor of Music at the Faculty of Music at the University of Oxford and is Henfrey Fellow and Tutor at St Catherine's College. An expert on 19th and 20th century music, she's the author of Beethoven, A Life in Nine Pieces. Professor Peter Franklin is Emeritus Fellow in Music at St Catherine's College at Oxford. A leading expert on Gustav Mahler, he's the author of The Life of Mahler, as well as the book Mahler Symphony No. 3. And he's also the author of The Grove Music Online Entry on Mahler. Dr. Genevieve Arkell lectures in the Department of Music at the University of Bristol, an expert on music, meaning and sociocultural change in Austria and Germany in the 19th and 20th centuries. She's the author of the article Gustav Mahler and the Crisis of Jewish Masculinity, published earlier this year. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome. And Genevieve, I might begin with you and I might begin with a personal question about how you became so interested in Mahler, because you were originally thinking about a career in psychology and suddenly then a performance of Gustav Mahler's Second Symphony changed the course of your life.
Yes, that's the nuts and bolts of it. I didn't ever plan to be a lecturer at a university. I wanted to go and be a therapist. So I've had quite a course correct in many ways. I was always a singer when I was a child, and I kind of got to my A-levels. I was taking psychology. I took music as well, but it wasn't my primary area of interest. But the choir I was in were invited to perform in the BBC proms to do Mahler 2. And I didn't know who Mahler was. I didn't particularly care about Mahler. And then got together with the orchestra for our big rehearsal for it, and kind of had that lightning bolt moment where I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, I didn't really know that music could move me the way that that piece moved me at a kind of young 18 years old. And I kind of realized I wanted to understand why it moved me. I wanted to investigate how music makes us feel that way. How do I feel elements of Mahler's biography or his experience embedded into this work? So I changed my undergraduate degree. I went and did music. I wrote my undergrad dissertation on Mahler 2, and then I've been kind of riding the Mahler wave all the way through my PhD and to where I am now.
And Genevieve, is there something unique to Mahler that moves you in a particular way when you hear the music, or is it there in the works of all the great composers?
I think it is very much a subjective thing, isn't it? Some people are moved by different things. But what I love about Mahler maybe we'll talk about a little bit more. I call him a patchwork symphonist because I love this blending of different styles. He's always very creative with how he plays with genre and incorporating bits of song or reworking the works of his earlier song cycles into a symphonic context or taking little quotations from other composers. And I love this kind of patchwork that he creates. I find it very exciting and exhilarating to listen to, as well as him creating some really poignant, sentimental, but still exceptionally moving moments. And I think that variety is what always keeps me interested in Amala work. And every time I listen to it, there's always something new to grab onto.
Peter, instead of beginning in the year 1860 when Mahler is born, I want to start with you in 1911 when he dies, because would it be true to say that when he died, he was probably more famous around the world as a conductor than a composer? And looking at the afterlife of the music is fascinating, because he was hated by the Nazis because he was Jewish, and that prevented circulation of his works in the 1930s. And it really took a new wave of conductors who championed his work afterwards that led to us rediscovering the music of Mahler.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably fair to say that performances of his music did go on during the 30s and 40s. But as you say, largely thanks to conductors he'd worked with and who knew him, people like Bruno Walter, for example. And then, of course, I suppose it's fair to say that his music, yes, you're quite right, he was best known during his lifetime, really most widely known as a conductor. But it's a very fiery sort of star conductor, as we would say in modern terms. But during the last decade of his life, his music was gradually catching on. And it had, some of it had been very successful at first performances, but to specific parts of the audience. Probably the younger part of the audience, not the older generation critics, for example, who found it all a bit too much. And then gradually, of course, a lot of Jewish emigres from Europe, Germany, and Austria, for example, ended up in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, working in Hollywood, desperately trying to find work as musicians. I'm talking about not only composers, but conductors, and also many performers, of course, members of orchestras, who ended up playing for Hollywood movies. And indeed, composers like Korngold, who had known Mahler, lived in the German sort of artistic grouping in Los Angeles, and all knew each other with literary figures like Thomas Mann. And it's in that one of the contexts in which his posthumous reputation as a composer really began to develop.
And Peter, do you think that there is something cinematic in the music of Mahler as well, that probably was one of the reasons why they loved him so much? Because even though he wasn't writing for the cinema, there is that kind of cinematic element to it in the way he's telling these different stories in the symphonies.
Oh, yes, my goodness. I could talk for many hours on this subject, but I will try and be brief. Essentially, Mahler was as a composer, was associated with the so-called New German School. This meant people like Wagner and Liszt, and its young hero was Richard Strauss, who was much more quickly known as a composer than Mahler was, although they knew each other and got on very well. And the characteristic of the New German School was that it was trying to extend the realm of musical meaning, really, so that symphonic works became narratives, operatic works were musical dramas as much as real dramas set to music. The issue of drama and narrative is what really, really is heightened in Mahler's works, I think, in a very sort of New German School way. He was influenced by Wagner, and even from the first symphony, he turns the symphonic experience into an immersive one. There are offstage instruments. So suddenly the concertor, and this is particularly in the second symphony, and I share Genevieve's experience of having come across that at an early stage of my life and being changed by it. But I mean, in the first and second symphony, and the third symphony, you suddenly have offstage instruments as if the whole concert hall is part of a wider immersive experience. And I would argue that many of his techniques of musical narrative, in a sense, anticipate those of cinema to come. Flashbacks, rec- chord themes that are linked to characters in notional dramas that he calls heroes. So, I think there's a lot of these potentially cinematic. And you could say that when the next generation end up in Hollywood, they end up writing music for films, which was originally regarded as a put down of music, as making music subordinate to the drama. But you could say they're like those movies become sort of symphonies turned inside out, with the narrative now in the open rather than covered up by a polite words about pure music and the classics and all the rest of it.
And Laura, do you think that's why he didn't write other types of music? He doesn't write operas, he doesn't write the types of works that, say, Mozart would have been doing, piano concertos and violin concertos. It's very much a focus on symphonies and song cycles and, you know, some other smaller pieces, but that's primarily what he's interested in.
In some ways, I think it's because that's the music that he had access to as conductor, was able to write for these large symphonic forces, and he was so active as well in the opera house that he also knew great singers who could perform his songs. I think if we're thinking about the late 19th century, early 20th century, and what kind of genres people were composing generally, unless you were a virtuoso pianist, you were not necessarily writing concertos. And I think if you were interested in exploring what music could do post Wagner as a contemporary of Richard Strauss, and really thinking about the full capacity of orchestra and voice through the symphony and song was perhaps what attracted Mahler, rather than thinking, oh, I must write an opera. So I think some of these generic questions are partly dependent on practical issues, but also the idea that the world was so open to him through the orchestra and through the singing voice that he didn't really need to pursue those other kinds of smaller scale genres.
And it is fascinating, Laura, to look at his conducting career, because it starts off small in various Royal Municipal Theatres. It moves on to Vienna and Leipzig and Budapest and Hamburg. And then he has these appointments in Vienna, including with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. In 1908, he heads to New York and he's with the Metropolitan Opera and then with the New York Philharmonic. That it is a very impressive career as a conductor.
It is. And I think that's part of Mahler's life that we tend to overlook now in favour of his compositions. As Peter mentioned, he was famous as a conductor for his temperament, for his fiery temperament, and wasn't always terribly popular with orchestral members or singers. But that was also his way in which he could earn his living and establish a reputation internationally. So I think you can see the vast array of experiences he has as a conductor, is feeding directly into the kinds of music he chooses to compose.
And he seems to be in a bit of a somewhat emotional conductor as well, in terms of his expressions and gestures and so on, because I was reading some accounts of how he was mocked by some critics in New York because they thought he was perhaps being too extravagant in his gestures.
Yes, there are all these caricatures of Mahler on the podium with arms wildly flung apart and his hair also fairly dishevelled. I think Genevieve will have a lot to say about this as well. We have the accounts of Mahler as conductor, but we also have imagery and caricatures and perhaps prejudices against the way in which he approached conducting. So I think it's a complex picture of trying to understand what people saw and how they interpreted it.
Yeah, that is very interesting, Genevieve, because he did face anti-Semitism throughout his career. His music certainly faced it after his death as well. And I wonder how much we have to view his treatment in his lifetime through that particular lens.
Oh, absolutely. It's something that is kind of the thing that's often talked about with Mahler, is this Jewish question that emerges. And it's not something that's just kind of localized to his music, but also to his conducting, with this kind of physicality of the Jewish body that was very much being talked about in the kind of turn of the century, particularly in Vienna. We know that anti-Semitic kind of rhetoric had been building since about kind of early 1800 across German-speaking lands. But we started to see a real accumulation of it in Vienna at around that time. And so Mahler's being kind of pulled apart in various different forms. Richard Wagner wrote an essay called Judaism in Music, which ended up kind of functioning like a handbook for critics to kind of view works through an anti-Semitic lens and claim that, you know, a composer was more Jewish because they were quoting or referencing the ideas of other composers. They didn't have an original voice of their own. They were stealing, they were borrowing all the time. But similarly, the way he presented himself on the podium as this kind of, or the way that he was presented on the podium in these caricatures as being this very eccentric I don't know how to say that, words like throttling and snatching were used to describe him as a conductor, which was a kind of counterweight to some of the more considered to be more German conductors who were, you know, considered to be strong, masculine, pure in their conducting style. So it even came down to a physicality and presentation of the body and how kind of anti-Semitic discourse infused into Mahler's world.
And it's very interesting, Genevieve, that although Wagner was so notoriously anti-Semitic and had those had that book on how to identify some of these things, nevertheless, Mahler loved his work, made various allusions and references to it in his own works, and was a huge influence on his musical style.
Absolutely. It's still a question that I'm not sure I have an answer to, actually. I spent 3 years of my PhD trying to work that out and never quite got there. Particularly this kind of deep infatuation with Wagner and love for Wagner, despite his anti-Semitism, what I was particularly interested in was Mahler's musical quotations, particularly to a motif in Wagner's last opera called Parsifal, which was, it's kind of a religious story set around the Easter holiday. And it's got a motif in it called Christ's suffering, or the Savior's lament. And Mahler quotes it across so many of his songs and symphonies. And I spent a lot of time trying to think, what on earth is a Jewish-born composer doing quoting Christ's suffering repeatedly, or a Wagnerian version of Christ's suffering across all of his works? There's a lot to be said about how Mahler identified religiously, whether he kind of saw himself as Jewish, or he later converted to Catholicism in 1897. So did he see himself as Catholic? I'm not sure about that either, to be honest. Maybe Peter might have some more to say about that. But there's certainly a big question mark around his own sense of self-identification, even though society was definitely projecting a very strong Jewish lens onto him.
Yes, Peter, I wonder about that. Was it more that the music spoke to him? And is it that because of the particular circumstances in which he was writing and conducting made Wagner a more of an ally for him in terms of what he was trying to do musically?
My goodness. But I absolutely agree with what Genevieve was just suggesting. That I would say that Mahler himself didn't really know what to make of his own Jewish nature and origins, and indeed of his religious belief. We know from Alma's famous autobiography that periodically they would encounter so-called Ostjud kinds who looked very Jewish, who'd come from the East, were essentially immigrants. So he encountered these in America as well as in Vienna. And he would turn to her and say, "Ah, these my people." And his, of course, he converted to Catholicism because he had to; otherwise, he would not have been able to become director of the Vienna Opera in his 30s, which was an extraordinary thing for any young man, let alone a young Jewish man in Vienna. So that was required, and it's clear that he went through conversion really sort of political and career-orientated reasons. But, of course, he was also a deeply philosophically introverted and serious figure, sometimes to his own disadvantage. And all of his music that deals with spiritual themes and intuitions is very seriously thought through and deeply intended. And is complicatedly linked to his particular version of modernism, really, which was this post-Wagnerian modernism. I think what he got from Wagner, for all that he said actually, we should really just dispense with all of Wagner's writings. What matters is the music. And I mean, that's a problematic viewpoint, of course. But I think what Mahler found in Wagner's music was just this expansion of what Beethoven had been doing in the symphony, and the increasing range of the possibility of the expanded orchestra to capture what Mahler described in one famous letter as the different colors of the rainbow, nuances that the modern composer needed to work into his music, into his or her music, because it generally meant his at that time, which were not expressible by straightforward means, certainly the means, for example, of chamber music, which is why he shocked many of his contemporaries by orchestrating Beethoven quartets and indeed Schubert as well, and reorchestrating Schumann to make it sound more Wagnerian. So it's a very complicated picture.
It's a very complicated picture. Well, tonight we are trying to tease out some of these complex issues in the music and life of Gustav Mahler. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking about his relationship with his wife, Alma, and also talking about those great symphonies. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history as we look at the life and music of Gustav Mahler. My panel of experts tonight, Professor Laura Tunbridge of the University of Oxford, Professor Peter Franklin, also of the University of Oxford, and Dr. Genevieve Arkell of the University of Bristol. Peter, maybe can you tell us something about his personal life? Because I was reading in your New Grove online entry about various unhappy love affairs with sopranos and people that he was working with, and then the marriage with Alma, and that also seems to have gone, you know, fairly badly for him.
It didn't go too well for her either. Genevieve will have plenty more to say about this. Look, his relationships are really, it's a really complicated field of study. And we know a certain amount about it, but of course, given the nature of the period and we're reliant on letters and things that people did and did not say, even to their friends, that is quite difficult to work out. We know a lot about Alma's relationship with Mahler because of her famously voluble autobiography, which exists in more than one form. And we also know about her subsequent relationships and marriages. And she was a quite extraordinary person. There's no question about it that probably in the initial stages, he saw her as a beautiful adjunct to his role in Vienna. Did he fall in love with her? We're not sure. He certainly did by the end of his life, which is part of the tragedy of their relationship, that only when she had more or less had enough of it, did he realize that he really loved her. And it's deeply tragic. And of course, that expresses itself particularly in his later music. Some of which, including the last, supposedly unfinished 10th symphony, the score is covered with quite painful annotations directed to her and referring to her.
And of course, she goes off and finds a lover, someone who does appreciate her more. And Mahler asks her to choose between the two, and she chooses Mahler, but she still continues the relationship with the other man.
That's right, with Walter Gropius, who, of course, we know subsequently is the founder of the Bauhaus and a very important figure in 20th century design. But she was having other affairs as well, and she didn't last, and the marriage with Gropius didn't last terribly long, although they had a daughter, Manon, who died very sadly as a very young woman, and was memorialized in Alban Berg's Violin Concerto, which was sort of dedicated to her. But she ended up married to the novelist Franz Werfel, and she would, even as when she was married to Mahler, she would constantly bewail the fact that she kept marrying Jews and was quite openly anti-Semitic. And indeed, in her period of life with Werfel in Vienna, she acted as a hostess to all sorts of all the leading political figures, and even was rather inclined to Adolf Hitler, and later said she would have stayed in Vienna had it not been for Werfel being a Jew and she had to leave. It's an extraordinary life. I mean, she was a wonderful, complex, and difficult figure. But yes, my goodness, that relationship was really fraught. And Mahler behaved badly initially. He told her there was only going to be one composer in their relationship, and it had to be him. He was uneasy about her having guests when he wasn't at home. She had to suffer his summer house on the Wörthersee, which was far from sort of centres of culture. And she was stuck in the house alone while he rushed up into the forest to his composing hut to work during the day. It was a tough life for her, and subsequently, and as a result, tough for him as well.
Genevieve, Alma is fascinating. We could do an entire show on her as well, I think. And your new research is focusing on Gustav and Alma and looking at the worlds they were living in and issues of gender and sexuality in that period.
Absolutely, yes. It was something that had always kind of sat in the back of my brain that I'd wanted to explore a little bit, is this dynamic that Peter's mentioned about Mahler's kind of control over Alma and his later kind of reinstigation of that love later on after she had her affair. But what it really stood out for me about this was this kind of, it's a reflection of a dynamic that was happening in many couples across this time period, where you started to see a change between the boundaries of masculinity and femininity. And particularly as women in the early parts of the 20th century began to develop more independence, more autonomy, and start to look beyond the roles that they'd been assigned in the 19th century, men started to feel threatened and insecure about this change. And if you think about the fact that Mahler and Alma met in 1901, just on the cusp of this kind of turn into the new century, it really was a time where, and she was such an outgoing socialite, independent woman who was a very gifted composer as well. You can see how in that context, Mahler probably felt quite threatened by this change and what that maybe meant for the gender roles that had been assigned inside their marriage. And so I've kind of been interested in unpacking some of that, but also focusing on Alma and her work as a composer, not as an appendage to her husband or as a kind of lesser composer because she was a woman, but spending some time interrogating the works that she did compose. We've got 17 songs that exist from her. Up until only a few years ago, there were only 16. The 17th was discovered around 2018. Or was published around in 2018. So they're still very new. We know that she composed more things, but sadly, when she fled to the US during the war, she took all of her husband's manuscripts with her, as she well knew that they would be very valuable and they would probably also finance her for a period of time. But she left the majority of her own manuscripts behind, and we believe they were destroyed during the war. So we've got very little to work with. But it kind of opens up an opportunity for exploring the kinds of things that she was thinking about, maybe, you know, 1900, 1901, the types of poetry that she engaged with, the mindset of a kind of young woman in the early 20th century.
So, Laura, let's now talk about the great symphonies of Gustav then. And we've talked earlier about Symphony Number 2 and how, what meaning that has for Peter and for Genevieve. And it's interesting when you look at some of those early symphonies, like the Second Symphony, the way you see the influence of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the introduction of music in the fourth and fifth movements in the Second Symphony, and the way he tells this very large story in it. It's a gigantic piece, 80 or 90 minutes when it's performed. You know, it's not one of these quick fire symphonies from the 1700s.
It's certainly not. And that scale and ambition for the symphony might be seen as being something inspired by Beethoven, as is the inclusion of voices. So the way in which Mahler expands the orchestra, the sense of space within these pieces, as Peter alluded to, and then, of course, the inclusion of unusual instrument, as well as singing, are all things that you could say were perhaps taken from Beethoven and also Mahler's experience of conducting works like the Ninth Symphony. Of course, he himself completes nine symphonies and ended up embarking on a tenth that's left incomplete. So you can begin to think about how through Beethoven through Wagner, who also was a great admirer of Beethoven's works, that Mahler is in some ways inserting himself into a grand symphonic tradition.
And in terms of the symphonies, there's so much drama in them. The one that I personally love the most is the Sixth, and it has those famous hammer blows. I remember seeing a performance in London, I think it was at the Proms, I think it was Simon Rattle conducting years ago, and then they actually did have someone, you know, with the hammer to signify those blows of fate at the end. And there is this huge drama, there is this huge power in the works.
And we're so often pulled back to the biography to explain them, which I think is another very romantic way of thinking about how these works are put together. The Sixth is a favourite of mine as well. But what's interesting, by the time you get to the middle symphonies, to the Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, that some of the overt references to the outside world or to texts are actually brought into the music. And in some ways, they're much more conservative in their forms and working more within a conventional symphonic framework. But they still have this tremendous power and energy and an idea of invigorating from within some conventional forms. The Sixth Symphony, for instance, with its opening and final movement, just the scale of that, but also that we're still thinking about things in terms of sonata form. It's a very long way away from what might have been done in the 18th century, but it still harks back to that idea of thinking about the power of instrumental music to mean something here as well.
And Laura, what do you think of the Eighth Symphony? It's never been a piece of music that I've warmed to. It's known as the Symphony of a Thousand, which I think was a marketing title that someone gave it because there were so many people involved in terms of the choirs and orchestras and so on. But it's a grand piece. It's almost over the top. You can almost see it appealing to audiences in the 21st century because of the scale and grandeur. But in terms of the emotion and power, is it as good as the other works?
I wouldn't like to comment on whether it's as good. It's certainly enormous. And I think it was one of the most impressive pieces, very well received on its first performances. And of course, as you say, also is something that's tremendously attractive to musicians and to audiences today. And of course, has that festival aspect in simply its scale. I think it shows the range of what Mahler is able to achieve in these works. And Genevieve referred to them as patchwork symphonies. I think there is that sense that we can go from the enormous scale of something like the Eighth Symphony down to really transparent and lucid textures. And it's that range in some ways that gives them their power. Ultimately, there are other symphonies by Mahler that I prefer instead of the Eighth. But I think actually for its ambition and scale, it really is something that has a weightiness within his oeuvre that is worth taking seriously.
And Peter, what about the songs then, and in particular the Song of the Earth, Das Lied von der Erde, one of my favourite pieces, very powerful, beautiful poetry that he weaves into it. And it's described, I think, as a symphony for tenor, alto and an orchestra, but it could in a way be seen as a symphony in the way it's almost more of a symphony than a song cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I would just throw in a bit of a word for the Eighth Symphony. I think it's a terrific piece, actually. It's so difficult to put on, though, that we don't hear it often enough, probably, in the concert hall. But, wow, I mean, it's a massive Wagnerian symphony, the setting of a Latin, sort of Catholic Latin poem, and the last scene of Goethe's Faust. So Mahler is sort of reinserting himself in the German literary tradition, and his first performance in Munich in 1910 was one of the last great sort of 19th century premieres, really. Everyone who was anyone was there. Now, this, of course, leads on to the point, the question you're just asking about vocal music and Mahler. But Laura's probably got more to say about some of the songs than I have, but Das Lied von der Erde, of course, is a remarkable late work. There are suggestions that he was caught up with the old worry about composers writing ninth symphonies and then not writing any more. And is Das Lied von der Erde really another symphony, or is it not? Of course, it is in many ways. And as Laura has already pointed out, the earlier symphonies also include vocal movements. The Second Symphony has one movement that is really simply a concert aria, really, you could say. And all of this is linked into the complexity of Mahler's symphonic narrative. Now, Das Lied von der Erde heightens that aspect of Mahler's music, which throughout his career, right from the First Symphony, is linked to the singing leading line, which probably in 19th century music is most associated with the orchestral strings. But as we have seen, that Mahler brings in actual voices, actual singers, as an opera conductor, for goodness sake. And in that sense, Das Lied von der Erde brings the two forms together in the most remarkable way, using ancient Chinese poetry in German translation in rather bowdlerized form that he discovered in a volume that he'd been given. But it is a most extraordinary, wonderful work. It appears to be much affected by the family tragedy of 1907, when his eldest daughter, Maria, died of diphtheria. And it was a terrible event, and Alma collapsed and had to be seen by a doctor when the child's body was being taken from the house. Mahler was then examined by the same doctor and discovered to have a heart condition. And it's often presented, certainly was presented by Alma in her autobiography, as a kind of turning point where Mahler, as it were, turns to thinking about matters of life and death, and his sort of compositional farewell to the world. So it's the work of partly of great energy. It has drinking songs in the old Chinese manner, and it's dominated by an extremely lively orchestral texture throughout, which in the first movement is dominated by a strange kind of jabbering noise, which seems to be associated with the image of an ape in the graveyard sitting on the gravestones and gibbering with laughter at the folly of human life. And this sort of the last drink saying farewell to the world is then encapsulated in the long final movement called the farewell, the Abschied, which is an enormous movement, putting two poems together that ends with this wonderful kind of farewell to life, with the singer repeating the word eternally, eternally, the world will bloom eternally. And you feel that the voice is dying away, as if the composer who is writing this will himself disappear from the world that he's actually celebrating. So it's a most wonderfully
and Genevieve, you see the same kind of power in his Ninth Symphony and the unfinished Tenth Symphony, which I know are some of your favourites.
Yes, so actually I would say Der Abschied actually goes on my list as being in my top Mahler favourites, and sadly I'm with Laura in thinking the Eighth maybe isn't my top favourite. But the Ninth has been a really special work. It echoes a lot of the ideas that Peter's just talked about, with this kind of farewell to life around this period of real trauma in his life and his suffering with his health. The problem with the Ninth Symphony is that for a long time, people thought it was his last symphony. They didn't know of the existence of the unfinished Tenth Symphony. So after he died, there was this really big wave of, oh, it was Mahler's final farewell. It was the farewell symphony. And these notions of farewell were very much, and suffering and pain were baked into it. And then they discovered the unfinished tenth, and you go, oh maybe it wasn't his big farewell, because he wrote another one. So there's a lot of confusion around how we perceive the Ninth Symphony as a goodbye in some ways. But the last movement of the Ninth Symphony, I would say, has probably become one of the most famous pieces of Mahler, and personally one of my favorites, for its poignancy. The end of that movement, much like Der Abschied, actually just dies away. And you hear it in a concert hall, and you struggle to hear even the violins when they're playing. It's so quiet, and it just disintegrates into nothing. And I think that's what kind of gives that sense of this ending of life, this kind of life. It's a life cycle of a symphony, and this last movement really can reflect a proper dying away in many ways. And then you've got to a new life kind of restarted in that 10th symphony, with some really spellbinding and beautiful moments, but again, it's unfinished. We don't know what it would have sounded like had Mahler managed to complete it. We've got fragments of it and performing versions of it that work really well to give an idea of what that 10th symphony would have sounded like had Mahler completed it. But sadly, it lacks a lot of the qualities that we know of a Mahler symphony because we haven't got that full orchestration and that full sound world that we know of the kind of typical Mahler late style.
Well, tonight we are talking about the life, music and legacy of Gustav Mahler. We're going to take our final break now, and when we come back, we'll assess the legacy of Mahler and talk about some of our favourite works. So stay with us here on News Talk. Well, welcome back. We're talking history as we assess the life, legacy and music of Gustav Mahler. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Laura Tunbridge, Professor of Music at the Faculty of Music at the University of Oxford, Professor Peter Franklin, Emeritus Fellow in Music at St. Catherine's College at the University of Oxford, and Dr. Genevieve Arkell of the Department of Music at the University of Bristol. Peter, when we're trying to assess the legacy of Mahler, what would you see? What would you see his legacy? How do you think he's viewed now in the 21st century? And how does he stand in the pantheon of great composers?
Well, I think he's absolutely found his place in that pantheon. And celebrated in all sorts of ways, not least with his music, sometimes used, actual compositions by him used in film. Famously, the Adagietto from the Fifth Symphony in Visconti's Death in Venice. Not perhaps one of the happiest uses of his music. But I think it's that the power of this immersive experience of the symphonies that we've all alluded to in some way or other, that has simply taken off, along with the complexity of the expressive world that they each encapsulate, and the complexity of the drama and the narrative that they appear to be embodying in musical form, although he was very careful in later life to avoid being written off as a programmaticist. But this is a complicated problem to do with him establishing himself as something other than just a turn-of-the-century post-Wagnerian, even though that, in a sense, that's what he remains. And I mean, I would hang on in particular to all of the slow movements, beginning with the enormous, incredible slow movement of the Third Symphony, which doesn't die away, but ends in resounding triumph in D major, but goes through unbelievable pain with dramatic agony in the inner parts before you actually get there. And all of his slow movements right up to the 10th symphony, I mean, they are paragons of complex musical expression that are without equal, really.
Laura, for you, what is the great legacy of Mahler?
I'm still thinking about the idea of just having all of the slow movements and really liking that idea. I think the legacy, on top of what Peter just said, actually has to do with what Mahler enabled subsequent composers to do. He was a contemporary of Richard Strauss and conducted some of his works, promoted his music. Younger generations such as Arnold Schoenberg, Mahler was also supportive of. And I think encouraging composers to explore different orchestral timbres, the potential of instruments to be combined in unusual ways and unusual instruments to enter the orchestra, is something that we can still feel very strongly in the compositional practices of today. And of course, Mahler is still very much with us. He's still programmed a great deal in the concert hall, and I think that adds to the immediacy and the power of his music.
And Genevieve, for you, what do you see as the legacy and what do you see as a standing today in the 21st century?
Gosh, I think it's something that I've experienced once I started lecturing, actually, is that, you know, in the modern day, classical music is something that our younger generations are struggling to engage with, you know, more and more as time goes on. And many of the students who I've taught, when they first come in at an undergraduate level, they've not spent a lot of time with classical music, much like I hadn't when I was 18 or so. And I discovered Mahler. And there's something about a kind of accessibility and timelessness of Mahler's music that Peter mentioned in its kind of relationship with cinema and film, that actually I think makes it very easy for a young generation to listen to and to engage with. So often I've used Mahler as a kind of gateway to open that door for this younger generation of musicians to engage with classical music and see it as something more than, you know, maybe they think of, you know, Baroque harpsichord kind of styles and they don't find that very interesting. The cinematic quality, the variety and the breadth of what Mahler does in terms of musical expression and this, what Peter talked about earlier of these kind of offstage instruments and these really creative sound worlds, and using that as an opportunity to educate and to bring more people from the younger generation into our kind of classical music world.
And Genevieve, if you were to recommend one piece of Mahler for our listeners to introduce them, and of course people can go on online and in various music applications, they have the symphonies, they have the song cycles, what would be the best first piece of Mahler for people?
There's so many. I think it's got to be number two. The Second Symphony, it's the one that revolutionized my life and turned me into the Mahlerian that I am. And I think it's astounding and a really good first step.
Peter, I think given our debate on the Eighth Symphony, it's probably one that if we saw live in person, we'd be blown away by it. But it perhaps maybe doesn't work as well when it's only an audio recording, because the sound is never going to be as good as a live performance. But what would you recommend for our listeners?
Well, you can't go wrong by starting with the First Symphony, which is where I started. I was years ago, it was an A-level set work, and I'd never heard of Mahler. And my teacher had no idea what to do with this vast score. And I discovered I did know what to do with it. But I have to say, with Genevieve, the Second Symphony was the live performance of the Second Symphony was my first live encounter with Mahler. I mean, what can you say other than that? I mean, a musical apocalypse that doesn't end as an apocalypse, but somehow affirms life beyond religious fantasy. My goodness, what a work.
Well, that's quite a beautiful note. And Laura, the final word with you?
One thing that's been striking me as we've been talking is there are so many references to beauty and love throughout Mahler's scores, the way that he annotates his scores, and also in, as a theme in many of the songs, I'd probably go for something smaller scale, which is a Rückert-Lieder, and have so much to say about the beauty of the world as well as all his hopes for it.
Well, a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight of the life, music and legacy of Gustav Mahler. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Professor Laura Tunbridge, Professor Peter Franklin and Dr. Genevieve Arkell. And that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and to Hannah Flam, who helped us with research on our Mahler programme. Well, we've got more debate and discussion next week and indeed in the weeks ahead. So hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night and Happy New Year. We'll be right back.